Well, thank you very much. And I want to start off by saying that I appreciate very much, as a person who worked for the government, who teaches and has studied political history, I appreciate what you are doing in the classroom. Because, you know, once universities gave up required courses, it's quite possible for students to go through 4 years in college without ever taking a history course or a government course. So therefore, the last time that many people have to actually get a class in civics or in politics or in political history or any history may be your classes. And I used to take people through the Capitol quite often, and they would always say at the end of the tour, oh, this was so good, they didn't teach us this in school. And I would always say, yes, they did, you just weren't paying attention. So, yeah, please keep it up along the way. My job today is to talk about six milestones that define the United States Senate. And I know that you're not going to get a chance to teach a course on this, or maybe even a whole class on this. I'm going to be talking about things that I know you can't teach as a whole class or as a whatever, but I think you can inject into classes, because all of these, I think, are going to be discussion points that you can get students perhaps to think differently about things, and especially sometimes differently than the textbook. And I say this as a person who has been working on high school history textbooks since the 1970s, when I got started in doing this. In the 1980s, when I had the chance to take an old standard textbook and update it, I went back through the whole thing, and I discovered that when you start off on the first, after the Constitution is adopted and the government gets started, the old book had a chapter on the first president, or had a section on the first president, had a section on the Supreme Court. It had nothing about Congress. It just sort of assumed, well, Congress was there and they were doing their thing. And in fact, that was one of the first things I added into the book was a section on the first Congress. And so the first of my six milestones that defines the U.S. Senate is the Constitution and the first Congress that met from 1787 to 1789. That was, in fact, one of the most productive Congresses in the history of the nation. It was as productive as the Congress at the beginning of the Civil War, at the beginning of the New Deal, at the beginning of the Great Society. It passed a phenomenal amount of legislation at that stage. I used to ask my students to start the class by reading the Constitution, and they always complained bitterly that they had to read the whole Constitution. I said, you don't understand, it's the shortest document you will read all year. You know, if you ask them to read the Texas State Constitution, it's the size of a phone book. This is a tiny little document that has been rarely amended. It's only been amended 27 times. 11 of those 27 amendments were actually passed by the first Congress. In fact, the most recent amendment to the Constitution was one of those passed by the first Congress. It just took the states 200 years before they got around to ratifying it. The first Congress is a terrific teaching tool in a lot of ways, because our Constitution is so short that it leaves lots of gaps to be filled in. Who filled in the blanks? Well, in many ways, it was the first Congress. And many of the authors of the Constitution were members of the first Congress. And they debated what they had left out and in what was the vague sections. For instance, pretty much the entire federal judiciary was left to be filled in. And the Judiciary Act that the House and the Senate dealt with in the first Congress defined the court structure of the United States at that stage. The first article of the Constitution, which deals with Congress, is actually longer than both the second and the third articles dealing with the President and the Supreme Court combined. This actually has been an advantage for the presidency, because Congress is so specifically delineated in the Constitution. The courts have said, well, this is what Congress can do and what it can't do. Whereas with the president, it's so vague, pretty much anything the president does in those fields has gotten by, one of which is foreign policy, in which the president has taken the great lead, because the Constitution is extremely vague as to what the president's foreign policy powers are in particular. The Constitution left out anything about a Bill of Rights, which, of course, was an issue in Philadelphia. But essentially, at the end of that debate, they said, we're too tired to deal with that. You know, that's extraneous. We're not going to deal with it. Of course, when it went to the states for ratification, they realized that the states weren't going to ratify the Constitution unless there were guarantees. And so James Madison campaigns promising that in the first Congress they will address this. And when he brings this up, people are saying, oh my goodness, you know, the ink isn't even dry on the document yet. Why are we doing this? And he said, basically, we've pledged to do this. And so so much comes out of that first Congress. There's a terrific book. I've given you some suggested readings of Fergus Bordowich's recent book about the first Congress. It's absolutely superb. He's a journalist, so he writes very well, but he's also a very deliberate researcher. And has made a great amount of headway in trying to make sense of that Congress. And I will say now that we will have those debates about the courts and how the courts interpret the Constitution. And there is a well-meaning feeling in the courts that, you know, we need to go back to the original ideas of the members of the authors of the Constitution. We need to, you know, confirm, you know, exactly what they had in mind. And actually, if you read the debates in Congress, the people who had served in the Constitutional Convention were disagreeing with each other as to what it all meant. There was a great amount of argument, and in fact, we can then discuss how the federal government has grown through continued arguments over what the Constitution meant that actually began right away in the first Congress. So the first Congress is by far one of the those important pieces. And I can't believe that my old textbook left it out completely. I hope that the current textbooks are better with dealing with those issues, but certainly this is a great discussion point. Moving ahead, the second milestone is the Compromise of 1820, known as the Missouri Compromise. And you know, you've all got to deal with the Missouri Compromise at some point, but what's a different way of looking at the Missouri Compromise? Think about how fast the United States grew. Between 1804, when we get the Louisiana Purchase, and all of a sudden, settlers are moving west. And they're moving west at a faster pace than anybody anticipated. As soon as enough people get into a territory, the first thing they do is send a representative to Washington and apply for statehood. Between 1804 and the Civil War, the number of states more than doubled. This is phenomenal. I mean, the last time we added states was in 1960. Can you imagine if since 1960 the number of our states had doubled? What would that have done to the political process in the United States? I refer to this as the adolescent growth spurt in American history. And that's probably one of the reasons why we felt so much angst about what was going on in this period. Who are we? What are we? What should we be doing? And it had a huge impact on the Senate and the House. Well, the House had just kept adding more representatives. In the Senate, you've got two senators for every state, regardless of the size of the state coming in. And during this period, starting in the 1820s, one of the really critical issues was, will these new states permit slavery or prohibit slavery? And there was a balance in the United States Senate between the North and the South. In the House of Representatives, the northern states were growing in population faster, so they were getting more representation. But in the United States Senate, the North and the South were going to be essentially equal. And that's really the genius of the Missouri Compromise that gets brokered by Speaker of the House Henry Clay, which is, okay, Missouri, which is the first territory west of the Mississippi that's applying for statehood, is going to have slavery. And how is that going to affect the rest of the Senate? Well, we could bring in Maine, which had been a territory of Massachusetts up to that point, and bring in Maine as a free state. So we'll balance these two. And if when you walk from the U.S. Capitol over to the Senate Hart Building, where I used to work, you walk past all the flags of all the states in the order that they came into the Union. And as you're walking along, you notice, well, it says Arkansas, Michigan, you know, Alabama, Wisconsin, Mississippi, you know, Illinois, and it's where there is this back and forth balance that's going on. Well, what impact did that have on the United States Senate? Before the Missouri Compromise, the U.S. Senate was in the shadow of the House of Representatives. The real action was in the People's House, which is the way most parliaments are. The Prime Minister serves in the lower house. And the former prime minister is in the House of Lords. You know, former prime minister goes to read the newspaper in the House of Lords because it has very little power by comparison to the people's house, the lower house. And that's the way it was from the beginning of the Republic until the 1820s. Henry Clay, as a young man, comes to the Senate and so bored with the Senate, he quits it to go to serve in the more turbulent house, as he calls it, goes to the House. This does not happen these days. Senators do not give up their Senate seat to run for a House seat anymore. But in those days, he saw that a political future was going to be defined by getting into the House. Well, once Clay, as Speaker, brokers this compromise, the really astute young politicians in the House of Representatives realized that on the single most divisive and emotional issue of the day, the Senate was going to be roughly equal between the sections. And so you see this gravitation of people like Henry Clay and Daniel Webster and John C. Calhoun leaving the House of Representatives and going to the Senate. And it's in the 1830s and the 1840s that the Senate has what's called the Golden Age of Debate. And the debate is largely over sectional issues, and particularly as moving up to the slavery debate. So the Compromise of 1820 is what puts the Senate ahead of the House in terms of clout on Capitol Hill. It doesn't give any extra powers, but the Senate starts to exercise those powers that it's already had in a much firmer way, and it gets much more national attention, and it never quite gives it up. So the Senate, if you talk to members of the House today, they'll all grumble about the Senate. You know, we're climbing up to Mount Olympus and things like that. We're the blue-collar body, you know, and this, that sort of thing. And the Senate is thinks so highly of itself. But the Senate is a remarkably powerful institution. It's the most powerful upper house of any Western democracy. Today, 50% of the U.S. Senate is made up of former members of the House of Representatives. And 0% of the House of Representatives is made up of former senators. Although we have had some notable examples like John Quincy Adams, who did go back and serve in the, having served as a senator and as president, going back and serving in the House of Representatives. The third of my milestones is the direct election of senators in 1913. This is the 17th Amendment, which, interestingly enough, has come back into political discourse, because there are some groups who have been arguing, well, the 17th Amendment changed the relationship between the states and the federal government, and we should repeal the 17th Amendment. They actually have people campaigning on the argument that you, the voters, shouldn't get the right to elect your own senators. State legislature should do this. Now, I can't quite see the voters jumping to that conclusion at any point along the way. But the 17th Amendment did change the Senate. And the question always is in what ways did it change the Senate? One of the ways that changed was that it actually blocked even more draconian reforms. If you look at what's going on in England at the same time, the British reformers are stripping power away from the House of Lords. And in the United States, the progressives who are pushing for more open and transparent and more responsible government, they don't take any powers away from the Senate. They change the way senators are elected. Because previously, senators have been elected by state legislatures. There have been a lot of scandals. There have been cases of bribery. It was easy for wealthy miners in the West to buy themselves a Senate seat, essentially. They came to Washington and built beautiful mansions along Massachusetts Avenue that are now embassies today. They brought their unmarried daughters with them. And there, in the congressional record in the late 19th century, there's a little symbol next to a senator's name if he has an unmarried daughter with him. And that it suggests that you need to invite her to the receptions that are going. Sort of the plot of all the Henry James novels. They try to marry off a very wealthy young woman to somebody who's got fame and fortune to some degree. The scandals that broke up about bribery was one of the issues. There was a feeling that senators represented special interests, powerful interests, not the people's interests. And so you have the series that appeared in Cosmopolitan, which was then a political magazine, about the treason of the Senate. And also there were some state legislatures that just couldn't cope with having to elect a senator. If you had a state legislature in which one party controlled one house and the other party controlled the other house, they sometimes would let an entire Congress go by without ever filling a seat in the Senate. And so something was wrong with the system. Political scientists actually figured that it would help the state legislatures to get this burden off of them by electing senators directly. And so in 1914, the first direct election of senators takes place. And there have been doctoral dissertations written about what this meant for the Senate. And one of them had looked in particular, tried to calculate every statistic that could be counted up. And the only noticeable difference was there were slightly fewer lawyers after direct election than before, which the writer of the dissertation thought was a detriment. I thought actually was an asset to the institution. But the really startling thing was that in 1914, at the height of the progressive movement, that first direct election, the voters elected every single incumbent senator who was running. So the voters really weren't that far off from the state legislatures. Sure, the state legislatures in Pennsylvania favored the steel industry, but the voters worked in the steel industry. You know, they didn't really see this as a different thing. It actually took the steam out of Teddy Roosevelt's Progressive Party. They thought the voters were going to flock to them. They were just shocked when the plutocrats got reelected. And it really was sort of a stunning blow to this whole idea that all of our political problems could be solved by turning things back over to the voters. Now, over time, actually, as you look at it, it has changed. A lot of people who are outside the political process now run for office. It used to be the people who were coming up through the state legislatures and the governors and others sort of naturally moved up into senators' positions. Now we have everybody under the sun coming into the Senate, including comedians are getting elected to the Senate. And Al Franken argues more comedians need to be elected to the Senate in the process. But I think that is one of the changes. And I cannot imagine that the 17th Amendment will ever be repealed. My fourth milestone is the defeat of the Treaty of Versailles in 1919 and 1920. And this may surprise you, because the defeat of the Treaty of Versailles is always looked upon as just sort of a blot on the Senate's history and upon American political history. That here we are at the end of the war, we can't even agree to ratify the peace treaty, and we don't join the League of Nations, and President Wilson says that means we'll have another world war within 20 years, and he's absolutely right about that. I'm not saying that the defeat of the League of Nations was a good thing, but it is a reminder that our foreign policy is not made by presidents alone. That foreign policy is shared by Congress, and particularly by the U.S. Senate. The Senate, which has the exclusive powers of advising and consenting on nominations, that means all our ambassadors, the State Department and others, and also the exclusive power to approve of treaties. And a two-thirds vote is required in the Senate to approve of treaties. The House has a role in this because any money that's spent in foreign policy, the House has to originate any kind of money bills. But otherwise, the Senate really has a major role in this. President Wilson, who was a political scientist and an historian, had written his doctoral dissertation about Congress, who had terrific ideas and had great influence. He's the one who convinces the Senate to create its first majority leader. He's the one who convinces the Senate to have a cloture rule to control filibusters. He's the first president since John Adams to go up and personally present his programs to Congress. He sees himself as a chief legislator as well as a chief executive, and he particularly admires the British prime minister and wants the president of the United States to act more like a prime minister. He's enormously successful at this for the first 6 years of his presidency while his party controls both houses of Congress. By gosh, when the opposition party wins the 1918 elections, if Wilson was the prime minister, he should have gone out of office. But no, he's president, and he stays in office, and he does not cope well with the opposition party, in particular because he personally negotiates the Treaty of Versailles in Paris, and when he comes back, he wants absolutely no changes to this. And that means there's no role for Congress at all in this process, no role for the opposition party. This is Mr. Wilson's treaty that he's presenting them. What he doesn't understand is that the Senate has the right to amend treaties. And you don't need a two-thirds vote to amend the treaty. You only need a simple majority. What's the rationale for that? Well, you've got to build a supermajority to ratify a treaty, to approve a treaty. And the way to do that is by a series of amendments that will get this treaty to the point where you can get enough senators to sign on. The danger, of course, is the other party of the treaty won't accept it if you've changed this treaty. President Wilson needed to authorize compromises. There were enough senators in the Senate who were in favor of supporting this treaty and even in favor of joining a League of Nations that they could have, with changes, they could have approved this treaty. And he adamantly opposes any kind of changes. And as a result, even his supporters have to vote against all of the amendments that are proposed. And the treaty is defeated twice in 1919 and 1920. One of the people who learns the lesson from this is Franklin Roosevelt, who is a junior member of the Wilson administration. And when Roosevelt is president in World War II, he makes a concerted effort to get members of the Senate involved in the peace treaty process, including Republicans as well as Democrats. And so you have Senator Arthur Vandenberg and Senator Tom Connolly of Texas going off to negotiate with some of the treaties that are coming up and getting the Senate on board with supporting the United Nations. And all of the successes that Roosevelt had in the 1940s in part were from the personal lessons that he had learned from Wilson's failures back in 1920. But that all presidents of the United States, right up to now, have to realize that foreign policy is not their exclusive domain. They have to share this with the legislative branch. And so that's why I think that's a milestone that that needs to be included. My fifth is breaking the civil rights filibuster in 1964. This has got to be one of the most dramatic moments in Senate history. There were two books that came out about this during the 50th anniversary. There's a play out and it made into a movie about Lyndon Johnson and Martin Luther King during that year. It's called All the Way. It's really good, and it deals with this enormous, not only was important issue that was being demonstrated about in the streets and being debated in Congress, but that created the longest filibuster in the history of the United States Senate, which it's always hard for us to count exactly how many days were involved in this because of weekends and times like that, but essentially people say now 60 days were devoted to this filibuster. Just to give you an idea of how long it went on, Roger Mudd of CBS reported from the steps of the Capitol every day that filibuster was going on. It was snowing on the first day that he reported on it, and it was over 100 degrees on the last day when they finally took the vote. So a lot of time. Roger Mudd, in those days, people on CBS used to get paid a flat salary and then additional for every minute or so they were on TV. And he made so much money, he built an addition onto his house in Virginia along the way. The whole question was about filibusters. And filibusters are unique to the Senate. You cannot filibuster in the House of Representatives. The leadership of the House realized it was too big to be able to allow small minorities to block things. And over time, they constructed the rules that the rules of the House allow the majority to act as long as the majority sticks together. That's a little problematic at times, but if the majority sticks together, they do not even have to talk to the members of the minority. They can just run right over them in the process. The rules of the Senate are very different. First off, you know the Senate is not a majoritarian body. As we heard earlier this morning, that the four biggest states have 30-some-odd percent of the House of Representatives votes and only 8% in the Senate. A majority of the population of the United States lives in 10 states. They have 20 senators. The rest of the nation lives in 40 states, and they have 80 senators. So we're not a majoritarian body. We can't be. And our rules of the Senate allow for blocks of senators and sometimes even individual senators to just bring everything to a halt. You've all seen, I hope, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. You know how Jimmy Stewart talks and talks and talks and finally collapses. That's not the way it really works in the Senate. A U.S. senator can get anything they want in many ways by just saying, I object, because the Senate does a very large percentage of its business, small and large, by unanimous consent. Mr. President, I ask permission that my remarks go into the record as if I read the whole record. We're all very glad you're not going to read the rest of your speech. Without objection, so ordered. Mr. President, I ask that this bill that's been reported out of the committee be approved, even without debate or anything, because we all agree on it, without objection, so what? So you can do something minute or something enormous as long as there's no objection. But, of course, unanimous consent means unanimous, means everybody. And that means the greenest member of the minority party who's just been sworn in can say, I object. And everybody says, why did you object? What is it you want? How can we accommodate you? This is the reason why 50 members of the House are now in the Senate. Because you become so much more powerful as an individual senator than you can be in this much larger body in the House where numbers are essential. Lyndon Johnson, as president, as majority leader, had presided over all sorts of filibusters. He actually got the first civil rights bill since Reconstruction passed through the Senate, but then the only way he could do that was by gutting the bill down to the point where it was close to meaningless so that the Southerners would not filibuster against it. But in 1964, there was so much agitation in the nation. They really needed a serious bill. And of course, John Kennedy had endorsed it and then been assassinated. There was an emotional response. And Johnson knew that his election in 1964, in many ways, was dependent on his showing that he could be an effective president and that he was not just a Southern president. He tried to be a Western president, but people did see him as a Southern president. He could be a national president. And so he pushed for the civil rights bill, and they kept this debate going for 60 days in the Senate. They blocked everything else out from being dealt with. The trick was to build a coalition in the Senate to invoke cloture. There were some senators who said they would vote for the bill, but they would never vote for cloture because it was sort of a philosophy to protect smaller states. They had to convince people to get over that issue. And they did that by essentially writing the bill in the office of the Republican leader of the Senate, Everett Dirksen. So even though the Democrats had practically two-thirds of the Senate themselves, and the Republicans were a relatively small minority at the point, he knew they needed the Republican votes to get that cloture, to cut off the debate. And so Hubert Humphrey and Mike Mansfield, everybody else who were managing that bill, spent their time in the back rooms of Everett Dirksen's office until Dirksen had felt comfortable enough with the bill that he could support it and bring enough people on board. A really, truly bipartisan effort that took place at that point. And once they established cloture, then passing the bill, that happened a week later, that was a piece of cake at that stage. But getting two-thirds votes in the Senate for anything is extremely difficult. The Constitution requires a two-thirds vote for overturning a presidential veto, for approving a treaty, and for removing somebody from office who has been impeached by the House. You only need a simple majority to impeach somebody in the House. You need two-thirds vote in the Senate. And people in the House forget this sometimes when they're sending things up along the way. Cloture was actually just a rule of the Senate, and they argued that that could exist at two-thirds because that was a constitutional number. It was after the Civil Rights Act of 64 that finally the reformers pushed through a change in the rules. They hoped to bring it down to a simple majority, but that was too drastic for the Senate. And they said, okay, instead of two-thirds, let's bring it down to three-fifths, which means instead of 67 senators, we'll bring it down to 60. And so these days, when people say, why does it take 60 votes to get anything of consequence through the United States Senate? I say, you don't understand. That's the reform. It used to be even worse than that. 60 votes is sort of manageable to some degree. In 1975, when they did pass this, the Democrats actually had 61 senators. So how come the Republicans allowed them to set the threshold at 60? Well, it's because back in 1975, both the Republican and Democratic Party had conservative and liberal wings. They never expected all of the Democrats to vote together. You had Democrats who went from Jim Eastland of Mississippi to Jim Aberesk of South Dakota, that you couldn't get further apart than those two people. They were never going to vote together on anything, except maybe a resolution to name a post office. But on anything of any consequence, those two were never going to vote together. And the Republican Party, you had Barry Goldwater and Jacob Javits, who were just as far apart. Nobody ever expected the liberal and conservative wings to run together in those cases. And so they were willing to do this because they expected votes were going to be bipartisan. Well, since then, of course, what's happened is the Senate and the House have become extremely polarized. Our party is actually much more like parliamentary parties, and that means that you stick together. So pretty much the Republican conference in the Senate is a conservative conference, and the Democratic conference is the liberal conference. The most conservative Democrat today has a more liberal voting record than the most liberal Republican in the Senate. There's very little middle ground in this process. And so that 60 vote threshold, therefore, became particularly difficult. And basically, minority leaders realized that they could block anything by just having 41 votes. They didn't even need their entire conference. They just needed 41 votes to bring. And so starting in the 1980s, the number of cloture motions that are introduced increases dramatically, and the number of failed cloture motions increases dramatically. And majority leaders began calling failed cloture motions filibusters. Nobody has said a word at all. Mr. Smith hasn't even come to Washington. He's just sitting back in his office, you know. But that's considered to be a filibuster. You can't count a filibuster. We don't quantify filibusters because nobody ever says, Mr. President, today I'm beginning a filibuster. They just say, I believe this is an issue that requires extensive debate because it affects the nation so much. And, you know, I may speak all night on this. But nobody ever says, oh, I'm filibustering at this stage, unless they say that to the press outside. But we know failed cloture motions. And this became an increasingly difficult issue on nomination hearings, as each party tried to block the presidents from the opposite party from getting their nominees through. And that's my sixth milestone, which is the nuclear option, which goes from 2013 to 2017. The nuclear option is a truly bipartisan effort along the way. Both parties have been on both sides of these issues. Originally, it was back when President Bush, George W. Bush was president, was complaining that his nominees needed up or down votes. Senator Bill Frist, the Republican leader, threatened the nuclear option, which was to change the rules by a parliamentary action so that it would require just a simple majority vote. Senior senators were so horrified that a bipartisan group from Gang of 14 got together and came up with a compromise that everybody could live with, so they did not detonate the nuclear option. And because Harry Reid, who was the minority leader, thought this would have been a horrible thing to have a nuclear option. Except in a few years when Harry Reid was the majority leader, we had a Democratic president, and the Republicans were doing everything possible to block every single nominee that the President Obama was putting up, Harry Reid, as majority leader, detonated the nuclear option. And Mitch McConnell, who had supported it when he was the majority whip, now thought it was a horrible thing that was being done to the nation, except that now that Mitch McConnell is the majority leader, instead of abolishing the nuclear option, in fact, they expanded the nuclear option. So now all nominees, and including Supreme Court nominees, can get through on a simple majority without possibility of cloture. And I was interviewed at the time, and newspaper reporters are always very agitated. This is the end of the republic, right? You know, is a great change going to happen and all the rest? And my answer was, the whole nomination process has become so fraught and so polarized, and it's gotten so blocked up. You elect a president, you expect the president, regardless of party, to nominate people to the executive branch who reflect their thinking, and also to the courts. That's one of the outcomes of a nomination. And there are ways in which senators can slow down this. And if somebody is really horrendous, they can build up a bipartisan vote to defeat them. But for the most part, they really need to stop filibustering on everything. And I thought that the nuclear option in this case was a reasonable thing. It's not a change in the rules, by the way. It's only a change in the precedence that the Senate operates under. This has happened. We now have a president of the United States who is calling on the Senate to do away with the filibuster on legislation as well as on nomination. This may be the only issue that President Trump and President Obama and President Bush and President Clinton would all agree upon. Every president of the United States has been frustrated by filibusters in the Senate. They would all like to see it simplified. They would all like to see it as a simple majority vote. Do I think it's going to happen? No, I don't think it's going to happen, because for the most part, it would diminish the role of every single senator if the filibuster was done away with. You may object to everything that's been filibustered, you know, all the filibusters have been going on. But the next issue that comes up may affect something that you hold very dear, and it may affect your state, and you want to have the power to block that. As the poem we heard earlier, thank God for the person who invented the brake. That is one thing that the Senate, as the deliberative body, has always maintained, is being able to stop things from coming along. And I suspect that senators will get up to the edge of the nuclear precipice when thinking about what, you know, should we have a filibuster or not have a filibuster. And they'll realize in the long run that it works in their favor, which is the reason why they've allowed it to continue for such a long time. And they will not give in to this urge to abolish it. On the other hand, I did an oral history with one of the former parliamentarians of the Senate who assured me that the rules of the Senate were perfect, and if they changed every one of them, the rules of the Senate would be perfect. So I do think that change is possible. In some cases, I expect change will happen, and probably not all the things that I approve of, but I don't get a vote on those issues along the way. I'm just an observer. Working as a Senate historian was one of the absolute great jobs for a political historian. You had a front row seat for the best show in town. And studying the Congress is just a terrific project. And in fact, for you as teachers, you now have more tools than ever before. I was at the very beginning of my career, I started teaching in high school, and the only tool I had was an A.B. Dick mimeograph machine. You now have the world out there. And the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House of Representatives and the House and the Archives have poured an enormous amount of material on the websites. My handouts that go along with my talk today have some references to what you can find on the Senate website. Everything that I've said here today you can find online and more, and your students can find. It's a terrific resource. So I'm very happy to have this chance to give you a very quick tour, a historical tour of the Senate and its milestones, and we have a few minutes left for questions. Thank you.